Roger, thank you for that. Let me call our panel up now. We're going to move on to one of the topics and look at more detail that we discussed there. They're going to look at the global impact of the U.S. energy revolution. James Ball is a special advisor to
Tashwa.
What does that mean?
It's a made-up word. It means Spotswood.
What does Spotswood mean?
It was my partner in my original consulting company.
Very well. Justin Dargan, Energy and Environment Scholar at Oxford, associated with Oxford Analytica. Welcome. And Jeremy Leggett, the English pronunciation. Non-executive chairman of the Carbon Tracker Initiative, the sponsors of our breakfast here today. How are we going to proceed with this? First of all, I'm going to move my stuff out of the way so that I'll sit at the end here. And this session between 10 and 10:45 is going to be about the global impact of this U.S. energy revolution. In many ways, the development of shale gas and of unconventional gas and tight oil in the United States has been certainly a huge game changer for the United States and could well be a game changer too for global energy markets. That's what we're going to look at now. And we'll discuss this and then I'll throw it open to the audience. Each of our panelists will speak for about 7 minutes, not more than 10, or I'll stop them. And then we'll have a panel discussion and a Q&A. James Ball, why don't you go first? The global impact of the U.S. energy revolution.
Can we come up there? Or?
No, I didn't. Well, actually, maybe better because we've got a flat room here that people get to see you.
Oh, that one's not working.
It's not very good.
Okay, John, just lost a hand. Hello, everybody. I'm going to take a subject that has already been well introduced, and I think it would be definitely an accepted assumption that the fundamental shift in the fundamental shift in the last 10 years in world energy has been the surge in U.S. shale gas and then oil production. For me, with a lifetime career in gas, it's nice that gas finally led. So it's gas and oil rather than oil and gas. Now, as is already mentioned, the U.S. was due to begin exporting vast quantities of LNG in around 2008-09 as world producers ramped up production and ship sizes to serve this market whose domestic production was expected to decline rapidly by most people. I would contest that it was it was universally accepted, but we'll come back to that. The important thing is that starting in about 2007-08, reserves have more than doubled from their level in 1993, and despite a surge in domestic consumption, seems to always follow cheap gas, less production, consumption goes up, the reserve to production levels, which is how you measure inventory management, the oil and gas business, have risen 160%. And that's after being steady for well over 70 years. So even before US exports of LNG begin next year, and as you will have seen in the little bio in your books, I'm on the board of the company that's going to export the first LNG, and we're targeting about a year from now, 2015. Even before that starts, the U.S. Shale production has had a global impact because Qatar built up to 77 million tons, which, just to put it in perspective, was about one-third of what the then world LNG demand was. They built that up largely to go to the US and Europe, and very little goes to the US and not much to Europe. So there's been a virtual export of the US for US gas for some time. Now, even though there's a ban on US crude oil exports, US exports of products have soared recently. But even without a direct US export, you can already see the dramatic effect of US shale oil on world energy. And I wrote yesterday's $100 oil maxim will be lucky to be today and tomorrow's $75. I'll revise that to $50, and I may be revising it downwards week by week. Now, this is not what was US global energy geopolitics was meant to be. On the eve of Barack Obama's 2008 election victory, it was expected that the US would struggle with self-sufficiency. I was at a conference with a number of people from this country and US experts right before, and the grand wizard of peak oil, Matt Simmons, was speaking. And it was not challenged when people said, oh, it's pie in the sky for US policymakers to think about self-sufficiency. Yet by 2012, the boom in shale gas was definitely a part of the economic climate that helped get Barack Obama reelected. So it's had a huge impact. It's had another unexpected impact on geopolitics, which is dear to the heart of the my fellow panelists, I think, and that is its unintended consequence on European policy on climate change and its mitigation. Now, I do not believe in policymakers setting the solution. And Andrew gave a fantastic example earlier. When the body that set those California limits in the 70s, it's called Squawk Matt, set the emission limits, they thought that their targets would force all of California to be on electric cars by 1990. But they didn't say you must be on 50% electric cars. They said you must be below this emission limit. And the market said, well, that will be internal combustion engine cars. Instead, European policymakers have said, we've got the solution, it's renewables. And what has happened? As a result of US shale, US coal being exported, the renewable drive in Europe has led to massive and unsustainable subsidies in particularly Germany, UK, and Spain. Very little material growth in reliable renewables, and a huge increase in coal imports, and therefore Germany and the UK have had increased carbon emissions following this solution. Had they instead said, this is the goal that we want, and let the natural market drive of gas fill the gap until renewables technology made it economic, there would be a whole lot less carbon. Indeed, if the UK were running at 70% load factor for its current gas-fired power plant, it would have about 60 million tons less carbon emissions than it does now. So, UK and Germany, they have increased carbon emissions and coal imports in their drive to reduce CO2 emissions. Well done. But this was not expected, nor was the US shale development. However, I think that it was possible to see, one, that peak oil was a silly theory. It's always been silly. It's been propounded every decade since the 50s. And it was also particularly silly to apply it to gas, as Matt Simmons did. But the question is, this leaves two big questions. Why has the rest of the world failed to replicate the US shale boom? And perhaps more importantly, what can go wrong with the US shale revolution? And I just want to wrap up on this. First of all, at that conference with me, with Matt Simmons, Lord Howell said it's silly for the US to assume self-sufficiency. Nobody disagreed. That turned out to be wrong. Last year he got in big trouble for saying that we should do fracking in this country in the desolate Northeast, and this was determined to be really bad news for Tory politicians in the Northeast, because everybody knows fracking's bad, don't they? That's why there's no shale revolution in Europe. It's simple, ignorant NIMBYism. I come from California, so I come from the fount of world ignorant NIMBYism. And I can tell you, it's rife all around the world. And there's a lot of other technical and geological conditions and infrastructure that make it unlikely that the US boom will be replicated elsewhere. But the other thing that I want to mention, I just want to close on this. Right now, in this room, to these people, what was the most important outcome of the recent US elections? The most significant, I would say. Can anybody tell me? Okay, I'll give you a hint. It's a result in a US state. And as a hint,
Louisiana.
I'm not going to tell you just yet, but you're close. As a hint, I could just inform you that the people in this city voted for Republican candidates for the US Senate, Congress, state governor, lieutenant governor, and state energy regulator by a majority of as much as 81.7% and as little, no less than 64.2%. Any takers? I'll tell you. It's the city, sorry?
I said Texas.
Ah, you're in the right state. No, you're wrong, major city. In the city of Denton, Texas, where those results are from, they passed by a massive majority of 59% to 41% a ban on fracking. This immediately lost the school board $1.2 million a year. Several million dollars were spent by the industry against this initiative. The proponents spent $75,000. Now, that's the butterfly wing you should watch for, because that is the thing that could undermine the US shale revolution as it has stopped it in its tracks in Europe. So, shale is a great mover and realigner of geopolitics, the biggest since the OPEC spike that Aldo showed you in 73. But the industry and policymakers alike must constantly build and maintain a positive reputation by word and deed. Or, for example, in this country, we could lose 600,000 tax-paying jobs in the oil and gas industry in order to support the subsidized renewable industry. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh, I'll leave that there.
James Ball, ladies and gentlemen. Just to give you an idea of the impact that shale has had on the United States. And the United States, even as recently as 2011, had a trade deficit in oil and gas of $354 billion. $354 billion had a trade deficit. It will be in balance by 2018 and probably become a net exporter of hydrocarbons sometime between 2018 and 2019. That is a huge game changer for any country's balance of payments. Let's hear now from Justin Dargan.
Would you prefer for me to go?
Yeah, I think so, Justin. Thank you.
Well, hello. I'm quite pleased to be able to address all of you today. And I want to preface at least some of my statements with this proclamation to the extent that I don't mean to be a pessimist nor check your little, but I think that there are some issues that we must consider when we look at the American shale gas revolution. But again, I want to say that I'm not a pessimist when it comes to what is termed as the US shale gas boom, although there are certain critical issues I think will certainly play a role in how this is going to develop over the next decade and two. So over the next few decades, it's been predicted, of course, that the US shale gas production is going to radically transform the global energy market, and I think that goes without saying, due to the technological revolution, I think, which of course is horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, which is properly known as fracking, of course. And these two technological developments have been able to transform complex gas reservoirs in the U.S. to become economically feasible for development. Now, at the moment, the U.S. is independent in terms of natural gas, so natural gas is self-sufficient, and it's expected that within the next two decades that the U.S. is going to be self-sufficient in energy overall, in hydrocarbons, so at least in oil and natural gas. However, the shale gas revolution is not a one-dimensional issue, of course. I think it's quite multifaceted, and certain factors I think that we should consider. So far, at least, before the U.S. begins to export LNG in significant quantities, there has already been a major development within the global energy market. And this development has been the marked reluctance of Asian LNG importers to sign on to long-term contracts. And also, they're fighting against pushing back against oil indexation as well. Now, this is due, of course, to the expectation that within the next 2 to 3 years that there is going to be significant amounts of American LNG on the market. Now, currently, there are about 31 LNG facilities that are being proposed and waiting for approval at the moment. And it's not necessarily expected that all of them will be approved, but however, I think the significant majority of them will be. And it's expected that the U.S. will potentially within the next decade export about 30% of its natural gas production. Although the discussion of American shale gas and LNG potential, it obscures a certain critical discussion that's taking place in the U.S. At the moment. And the debate concerns two main issues. It's whether the U.S. should commit itself to being an LNG exporting country or whether it should focus its natural gas bonanza domestically to build up its industrial base and also its downstream gas industries and what have you. Now, with the onset of the Ukrainian political crisis, at least one major factor, I think, that played a role to commit the U.S. to being an LNG exporting country, and exporting, of course, its shale gas bonanza across the world, has been the request from the EU for the U.S. to assist it in reducing its dependence on Russian natural gas. Now, of course, that's not the only factor, but I think that is a major factor and definitely played a role in the U.S. changing its position and wanting to commit itself to being an LNG exporting country, although, of course, it already exports LNG to Alaska, but a major LNG exporting country. Now, one of the critical issues, I think, is we need to concern ourselves with how much natural gas is there. Now, I'm not a follower of Matthew Simmons, I think, or nor a proponent of Matthew Simmons. I think that there are certain issues that need to be raised with his methodology and what have you. Although, when we consider how much natural gas is actually in the U.S., that's one issue. And then the other issue is the depletion rates of shale gas reservoirs. Now, when you consider, at least in the popular press, what they consider to be how much shale gas is, or at least natural gas overall, with the majority being shale gas, is contained within the U.S., one of the main figures tends to be about 2,100 TCF, so trillion cubic feet. Now, within that, about 300 trillion cubic feet is composed of proven natural gas reserves. About 600 is probable. Then you have about 700, which is possible, and about 500 TCF is speculative. So the often cited figure that you find in the popular press about the United States having about a century's worth of natural gas is based on the combination of all of these designations, so such as the speculative, the proven, the probable, and the possible. Now, if you only look at the proven, of course, the U.S. would only have about 11 years left of natural gas going forward. Although at the same time, when you look at the enormous amount of petrochemical products that are being proposed, and also LNG export facilities and what have you, then of course this is going to put upward pressure on domestic demand within the U.S. Now, in the consideration of depletion rates of shale gas reservoirs, I think that the only certainty that we have about this is that there's a fundamental uncertainty. So this is a very important point, because we look at the depletion rates, the average depletion rates are about 37% so far. So what this means is that there has to be constant investment in shale gas reservoirs in order to keep these production rates quite high. So I'm not necessarily saying that the dominant methodology of the EURs, which are the estimated ultimate recovery rates, is flawed. I'm not saying that whatsoever. But what I'm saying is that these are very high depletion rates, and it would necessitate a certain price level in order to continue to stimulate investment in these reservoirs. Now, if we look at the impact of U.S. shale gas on the global LNG market, well, the expectation of significant amounts of American LNG flooding the market has caused, as I mentioned earlier, Asian buyers to be quite hesitant, or perhaps I should say reluctant, to sign on to long-term contracts based on oil indexation from some of the major LNG suppliers, such as Qatar being one of the most notable examples. Now, this has had a certain impact, of course, in the slowdown of the LNG market in late 2013, and it also had a knock-on effect as well on LNG projects that were being proposed in East Africa, which have found a notable lack of investment. So the expectation of Asian buyers that by the end of this decade there's going to be a significant decline in LNG prices might be flawed to a certain degree, simply because there's not enough investment at the moment in some of these new LNG projects based on the expectation of American LNG flooding the market. Now, within Asia, there have also been other movements as well. So the Asian countries are pushing for regional coordination to form a type of, perhaps I should say, buyer's bloc to exert pressure on many of the LNG suppliers in the world in order to strengthen their negotiating position in terms of negotiating for import contracts and what have you. And Japan is the leading proponent of this particular movement. Now, we can already say that the assault against the dominant oil indexation framework and also destination clauses is beginning to bear fruit. Now, how is it bearing fruit? Well, State Oil, of course, one of the major energy companies in the world, has begun to offer all of its LNG buyers gas supplies that are based on spot prices. So all of its clients have access to that. In addition, Gazprom recently compromised with Eni in order to supply natural gas based on spot prices, and this was a few months ago as well. Now, I think that this is quite interesting that Gazprom has compromised with this, seeing that Russia, of course, was one of the, let's say, the leading countries in fighting against the incorporation of spot pricing in LNG contracts. So it's only a matter of time before this type of movement, or perhaps even revolution, I could say, spreads across the entire industry. Now, another phenomenon that we've found is that many companies which come from LNG importing countries are beginning to also buy stakes in many gas development projects in North America as well, and also in Australia, in the belief that this will help secure their position when it comes to negotiating for LNG import contracts. And lastly, and I think that this is also another point which has been slightly obscured, I guess, in the debate, has been that just as important as the potential for American LNG to spread across the world, people very rarely consider the spread of American shale gas technology spreading as well. And I think that this will be just as important, perhaps even more important than, let's say, this potential flood of American LNG which will come into the market. So, I think those are my major statements, and I would be happy to take any questions after.
Of course, we'll do that. Justin Dargan, ladies and gentlemen, our second panelist. And before we throw the discussion open, let's hear now from Jeremy Leggett.
Well, thank you, Andrew. One of the great things for those of us who are energy watchers is that these times things are so fast moving. You can almost take the headlines of any one day and structure remarks around those. So let me do that from this morning's Financial Times. And I think the top two would be, for those of us who had a chance to check it, the Bank of England is launching an inquiry into whether the oil, coal, and gas companies pose a systemic risk to the financial system. number one. Number two, we read that E.ON, the biggest German utility, is announcing today at a press conference the details of how it intends to get out of gas and coal completely and focus on renewable energy and energy efficiency. So we are doomed to live in interesting times, and we've teed up a very good discussion here. Let me come to shale and both the North American story and the narrative elsewhere in the world. But just briefly, let's have a look at this E.ON thing. And I want to take you to the flip side of the coin and answer a couple of questions that our chairman asked very perspicacity about the prospects for renewables and storage in particular. Why would a big utility be doing this? Let's take the recent report from UBS on the solar cost down trajectory and how it marries with the storage cost down trajectory. I do commend this report to you if you haven't seen it. It's a big thick thing, but it's got a very good executive summary, big team of analysts. And what they find is that by 2020, the OECD will be able to have a solar roof on our home, an electric vehicle in the yard, and a bank of batteries doing all the electricity we need in our home. And our capital cost would come back to us in 6 to 8 years. And every year, we'd be getting 7% pre-tax on that investment. And they argue, unsurprisingly, that if they're halfway right with this, it is going to change the face of the energy industry. We're talking about 2020, just a few years from now, in ways that people are going to really struggle to envisage. And of course, if you look at solar, the cost down in storage is around the corner. There's some projections here, but the cost down in solar is real. And another team of analysts at Lyons Bernstein have called it the terror dome since 2006. If you know this paper, they plot the cost down, the average cost down of solar in the world against the lifespan of a typical fossil fuel project, 30 years for an oil field or a central power plant. And what they find is it's so steep, it's almost vertical. And again, I commend that report to you as well. And the terror dome, they say, is already impacting the business models of the big utilities, and in fact, making those business models completely untenable, as we have seen E.ON itself say today. And that in short order, because of the link to transportation and electricity as the prime fuel of the future, they will also impact the business models of the oil and gas industry. So that's the backdrop of, if you like, the competitive pressures that I think will increasingly squeeze the oil and gas industry. And I know from my own, I wear a hat as a consultant looking at risk in big corporations, talking to some of these companies, there are strategic top to bottom reviews going on in the face of these dynamics. That's before you get to the CapEx cost up trend. And that's something in Carbon Tracker that we're very concerned about. And I'm sure everyone here knows this, but just in case, to reprise it, for the top 11 oil and gas, publicly quoted oil and gas companies, if you look at what's happened to them since 2005, their production collectively has gone down and down. And their CapEx since 2000 has soared. It's quintupled in size. So where is that business model going? Never mind about anything else. Never mind about the completely unrelated trends in clean energy. Where is that business model heading? And many of us who look at the American shale narrative do indeed wonder at the incredible technical things that have been done. I myself had a first career as an oil and gas person for 11 years. I actually did research on shale, funded by BP and Shell. But I look at this industry today, and I'm really concerned, and I can see why the Bank of England would be taking an interest. The top 60 companies that Bloomberg follows have clocked up a debt that is very close to $200 billion here as we stand today. And if you look at what the prospects are, even at the $100 oil price, for some of these companies, they weren't looking good at the moment. They're looking really dreadful, and only one company is projected, according to Bloomberg, to make more money than it spends next year and the year after, and that's EORC, the derivative of Enron. All the others are losing money. Of course, the majors have pulled out and written off billions in assets. So you really wonder if the economics is working. And it's not as though it's just a few fringe analysts looking at this. Bloomberg are all over it. We can see headlines from the last year in Bloomberg about drillers feasting on junk debt. And one famous one that I woke up to one morning, is the shale boom going bust? So, big questions here. And I think one of the things that must be motivating the Bank of England, I can't speak for them, of course, but they must, this is a matter for the Financial Stability Committee, this investigation they're doing. They must be mindful that there are things reminiscent of the financial crisis here. This incredible exuberance that we tend to have as human beings, and how that played out in the financial crisis, and could this feasting on junk debt be in some way a repetition of our collective failings in that regard? So I look at all this, and I can't persuade myself that this is in any way going to be exportable. And the UK is a seminal country in this regard. If you talk to people in the industry who want the shale boom narrative exported to the rest of the world, it's very crucial that it takes hold here, because we have a favorable political climate with the current government, and we have a lot of shale. All geologists will tell you that. But I think there are five reasons why it is doomed not to work, and we've already heard some pessimistic thoughts from James on this, which I would echo. But I think increasingly people are going to be looking at the economics and thinking, is it really actually going to keep going in the United States with economics like that? Are banks going to spit the dummy at some point? That's the first big question. The second big question is the local environment. And again, James has referred to this in that striking story of Denton. The US had to basically deregulate this industry to get it away. I'm sure everyone here knows that it was exempted from the US Clean Water Act. And now some of these time bombs that have been stoked up in the storage pits and the produced waters are beginning to come back to haunt the industry. And I would project a sort of growing snowball of those kinds of stories influencing people the same way as the Republican citizens of Denton have been influenced. There's also the global environment and, of course, the climate talks, and a lot of concern in the US scientific community that actually methane is not, natural gas is not better than coal if you factor in leakage from the entire value chain, from the wellhead all the way through to the hob. Big story to come out there. There's then the political issue, and here in the UK, if you superimpose a aerial picture of a sweet spot in a shale gas field in Haynesville or an oil field in North Dakota, and you superimpose that either on the Weald or the desolate north, I don't think it makes that much difference. What you get is a density of wells and a use of the B roads of rural Britain that would blow people's minds if they really knew what was going on. The water and the toxic chemicals in, the gas and oil out, and of course, currently, we would not allow standing ponds of produced water for the flowback in this country. That law would have to be changed. So you can't imagine it happening, because right now, as everyone will know, even the sample wells are experiencing incredible opposition in the Tory heartland of Britain. A single vertical well, not a fracked well, just to get shale samples, has thousands of people, many of them Tory voters, out on the streets. You can call it ignorant NIMBYism if you want, but this is politics. I wouldn't use those words myself. I think there's an element of justifiable concern. So the politics isn't going to work. And then finally, increasingly, you've got the risk of being on the wrong side of history here. And this, I think, is going to play very interestingly for the government, because they had good policies in opposition, apropos some of these things that E.ON are now waking up to, and we're seeing from the investment bank analysts on the cost down in clean energy. I predict a massive U-turn at some point from the government itself in the face of the opportunity cost of losing out to this solar storage clean energy revolution that is coming fast down the track, that of course the Chinese are picking up on. The Germans will hustle through ultimately, despite their little blip in additional coal burning. And that, I think, would be a forecast that I would make, intersecting the shale narrative with the clean energy narrative.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor. On what you said about solar power, if it's so economic now, can we stop subsidizing it?
Give it a couple more years, because you'll be able to do it in 2020. The industry's prediction is that in this country, no subsidies will be needed for solar by 2020. It'll be the cheapest option. And of course, you know, the UBS report has a quite steep cost down curve continuing from the present day to then.
But we were told that wind power would fall in price too. But the offshore wind generators are now wanting three times the market price.
Yeah, totally different technology, steel, all the rest of it. That's not extracted, I think, transferable to the solar and storage narrative.
All right, let me just go through some of the issues that were raised, first of all, with Justin. James, well, what do you make of Justin's remarks that perhaps there's not as much exploitable shale reserves there as the headline figures would suggest?
I don't think it was, sorry, Justin's point, I don't agree with that. Sorry, is this on?
I'll just bring it towards you, it'll be fine.
Right. First of all, just two things that I wanted to say on Justin. Almost all of the LNG that goes into Asia, which is by far the largest LNG market in the world, is on long-term contracts. And the Qataris have all of their LNG sold on long-term contracts, most of it going that way. Obviously, a US LNG project's not going to get off the ground if it doesn't have long-term contracts. Ours, for example, has already got over 20 million tons of long-term contracts, and it doesn't have junk debt financing it as a result. And most of it's going to Asian buyers. So I don't know where this reluctance of Asian buyers to buy long-term LNG comes from.
Secondly, isn't that a short-term problem, and that because of the imminent arrival of U.S. LNG on the market, that Qatar, which has always gone with long-term contracts, particularly in the Far East, is now unable to get its long-term contracts away because people are saying, I'm not going to sign up to these long-term contracts that lock me in to a high price because the Americans are coming and they'll be cheaper.
But Andrew, they already have. If you want to do that, I mean, the later speaker here and I worked on the last Qatari set of long-term contracts. We did that, I think, about 10 years ago. So that's done. That's a ship that sailed. And that's 77 million tons. It's currently the biggest exporter in the world. The U.S. Gulf will overtake that sometime in the early 2020s. That's already happened. And the point you asked me about the reserves, there's this, I find it unbelievable, but I guess if you're not in the industry, you don't understand this. A reserve to production ratio of 10 years does not mean your reserves are going to run out in 10 years. It means your inventory management is such that you've got 10 years in the warehouse. Car companies were considered massively successful by reducing their RP ratio to whatever it's supposed to be, a few weeks, and then they realize that just in time was too close. The US has had a reserve to production ratio of between 8 to 10 years for 7 decades. And now in gas, it's 13 years. In 2013, it was 13 years. Yet their production, their consumption went soaring up to 730 BCM. So they've been undermining on the demand side. There's plenty of gas already discovered, already economic. And you can't add up reserves. The probabilities do not add up. A proven reserve does not add to a probable. You have to work out the different sets of probabilities. So I'm not worried about that. What I am worried about is the assumption that the rest of the world can easily replicate it, because in the US you have a deep liquid market in labor, you have a deep liquid market in oil field services, you have a deep liquid market in infrastructure and transportation. You don't have those conditions elsewhere. And also the most important thing, and this is where the UK and Europe is really lacks behind, is that in the US, except in the city of Denton, I might add, in the US, local people get the benefit of production on their land. And one of the things that's happening in the US, which I regard as a retrograde step, is that they're beginning to disassociate mineral rights in your own backyard from the revenue. Those people that have, you know, a gas well on their field, they love it if they get the royalties. You take that away and they're going to be protesting. In the rest of the world, they don't get enough benefit. And this is in Nigeria and the Delta. This is going to be in the UK. It's going to be anywhere where you disassociate the local benefit from the revenue. And here is where the gas industry really has to take the property ownership lesson.
Justin, would you like to respond to that?
Oh, sure, certainly. I mean, I think perhaps I should reiterate is that, as I said previously, is that the only certainty is the fundamental uncertainty. So I wasn't making any conclusive remarks about the contours of the shale gas, let's say, production boom at the moment. But I think that there are certain issues that we need to consider. I think the issue of pricing, what is going to be pricing going forward? Of course, no one can necessarily predict that. But I think that if we look at the trends, it's perhaps going to increase. And I think one of the major issues with that is what was mentioned earlier in regards to certain environmental concerns. Now, that may be ignorant NIMBYism, or it could be perhaps viable concerns on the part of the local populace. That's not necessarily, it's not a position that I'm going to take. Although I think that the local populace is going to continue to become more and more environmentally concerned, and they're going to put pressure on local policymakers to take a stand and to impose some type of regulation in terms of the shale gas industry. I mean, so we can see the concern, whether it's whether this particular concern is justified or not, but about methane leakage, that has been something that has come to the forefront about 2 years ago. Now, of course, there are certain scientific studies that dispute that, but nonetheless, if people believe in that, then it will have an impact on the current climate change debate in the United States. And then there are also issues with whether fracking causes earthquakes or not. Now, again, I'm not taking a position on that, but what I'm saying is that at least the belief that perhaps fracking will cause earthquakes in certain jurisdictions will cause local populace to impose some type of regulatory standards, I think, on the shale gas industry. And then in addition to that, of course, we have the ever-abiding concern of water pollution. Now, I must again say that I am a proponent of the shale gas industry, and I think that the shale gas industry is causing a domestic renaissance, at least in the industrial sector within the US. But I think fundamentally what we do need to consider is that shale gas reservoirs are still imperfectly understood, and I think that that can't really be disputed because, of course, shale gas production really took off, at least we could say in the beginning of the 21st century. But on the whole, the reservoirs are not understood 100%. And I think that they perhaps will be understood much more within the next decade or so. But as it stands at the moment, the majority of the reservoirs are not understood 100%.
What do you say to Jeremy Leggett's point that we shouldn't concern ourselves with shale, but go straight to solar?
Well, I think that we...
I didn't say straight.
Well, by 2020.
Pretty
soon.
Straight?
Only 5 years away?
Sooner than that, but I didn't say
right.
Straight.
Oh, you get my point.
Yeah. Slightly linear, perhaps, I guess. Well, nonetheless, I guess what I would say is that that would... I'm not against the renewable energy sector. I'm not against that. But what I think that it obscures a certain issue that we need to consider is that one aspect of the shale gas revolution in the U.S. has been the rebirth, shall we say, of the petrochemical industry and the downstream natural gas industry within the United States. So, of course, you can produce petrochemicals with solar energy. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have solar energy, but what I'm saying is that if we do look at the development of the downstream natural gas industries, then that's where I think shale gas is extremely important, and that's why I think that there should still be focus on the development of natural gas. And if we look at what China is doing at the moment, one of the I would say the major drivers of the Chinese investment in shale gas is for it to build up its own domestic petrochemical sector as well, and for it to reduce its dependence on Middle Eastern petrochemical exports.
Of course, the Americans, Jeremy Leggett, don't regard solar and unconventional gas as an either-or. They're actually doing both. 30% of all new electricity capacity added in the United States last year was from solar, but they are still doing and indeed for some that is a hedge against, as America starts to export gas, they think the domestic price will rise because you've added global demand in at the moment as a protected market. So they don't see it as either, and they're continuing to invest in shale as well. So they don't see it as either or. They think, particularly in the Southwest, where there's plenty of sun in America, that let's get lots of solar because our climate suits it, and hey, we've got this magical gift called shale gas, let's do that, let's have both.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree with all of that.
Except you didn't think so for this country.
The two things are perfect bedfellows, including in this country. I mean, if you look at solar under these cloudy skies and gas for CHP, for example, perfect bedfellows.
So, sorry, I'm confused. Do you think that this country should proceed to exploit its shale resources?
No, because we will waste a lot of money if we do that. Oh,
sorry, I thought you said there were natural bedfellows.
Yeah, but you, I'm talking about gas through the conventional routes. It comes into this country at the moment in the transition. And I think this is one of the big challenges for the energy industry, because right now you've got people in some of the big companies who get what you said, and are looking at transition and looking at, you know, constructive marriages between the two technologies. You do, though, Andrew, have a lot of people in the oil and gas industry who are saying to governments, you must put the lid on renewables, because if you don't, you'll put off the gas investors. That's happening here. You talk to people in Whitehall and Westminster, so do I. That is happening all the time.
Well, there is no gas investment in Britain.
And all
exactly.
And all.
But there is no gas investment in Britain already.
No, but the people who want to turn the UK into a gas hub, as the Chancellor calls it, that bet, and you know, to keep the existing investments in place. So that's a problem. I mean, that's a political problem of you know, vested interests defending themselves at the expense of the opportunity cost with what other countries are very clearly going for right now.
Can I, you mentioned, I'll come to you in a second, you mentioned E.ON this morning, and you're not the only person that reads the FT, and actually you didn't quite give us the full story on E.ON, did you? Because, first of all, E.ON's a basket case. Thanks to German energy policy, is going to have to rack up losses in the fourth quarter of almost 6 billion euros. And it's not getting out of conventional energy at all. What it's going to do is it's going to consolidate its conventional energy in one company and unbundle all its renewable efforts into a new company in 2016, on which it will lumber all the debt of the old company. So why is that such a great vote in favor of renewables?
Well, let's wait till we see the detail in the press conference. And I have to admit that the article I read on this morning was in The Guardian, not the Financial Times, and they were very clearly saying...
Well, that may be why you got it wrong. I mean, I've seen the press release from E.ON. They are dividing the company into two.
They're creating a new company for renewables, which will take all the debt with it. The conventional gas, the existing power transmission systems where they make the money, that's all going to stay with the existing stock exchange quoted E.ON company.
But they're backing out of fossil fuels and into renewables and efficiency. That's the story I read.
Well, actually, the new company is now going to negotiate a new deal to bring in more conventional gas from Russia.
Anyway, let's see. But you know, I think the writing is very clearly on the wall with these kinds of developments. And as you know, Andrew, they're not alone in this kind of...
Oh, no, that's because every German utility is a basket case at the moment. James, well, what do you make of this suggestion? There is no question solar power is coming down in price. It's largely, there are almost no solar subsidies in the United States now, but it is increasing its contribution to the US grid. What do you make of the suggestion from Jeremy that actually there's much more of a future in solar than there is in going the shale route in this country?
Well, first of all, let's not forget that we have a conventional gas business of some size in this country too, which has also been punished. You know, 83% tax rates. I was told earlier this morning that this amounts to subsidy because it's not 93%. I'd like to see somebody in the renewable industry actually pay some taxes rather than take some subsidies. Here is a comparison. Last year, a market rate. Gas industry, gas power had to pay, it was getting £67 a megawatt hour. No promise from the government, no link, pays taxes, supports a massive industry. Nuclear, a deal was signed up at, that was market by the way, 92.5 pounds a megawatt hour. For 35 years, guaranteed plus CPI increase. Onshore wind, £100 plus 15 years guaranteed plus CPI. Solar, £125. Yeah, I could be economic too if you subsidize me at that scale. That's double the market price, 15 years guaranteed.
But Jeremy's point guarantee, is that the price would come, is now coming down.
I guarantee you, the people that already have them aren't going to let them go. It is the case that solar is having a fantastic cost reduction, that the investment of policymakers in it is has paid off to a large degree. It is not the case that its problem with intermittency has been solved, and it is not the case that Tesla-style batteries are going to be available in every house, or that once you have everybody being a generating power station, that they can do so without a grid, without anybody investing in it, without any backup power. So much more likely than his golden age of solar is UK blackouts, because we have squandered the transition period that we could have had with economic gas-fired power based on imports, LNG, and trying to develop a solar industry.
Jeremy.
Yeah, I mean, and there you see another safe prediction in the future, which is that when the lights go out, and I'm pretty sure they are going to go out, it will be blamed on renewables, not the failings of the incumbency, which has provided most of the energy up to now, and which hasn't succeeded in building a power station of pretty much any sort for a very long time. So, I think these cost down trajectories in solar are very real, and James said that they're going to continue. If you go around the investment banks and look at the analysts covering the area now, there's a feeling of great optimism about the prospects for this sector. And one of the things I think we always have to bear in mind, when people talk about subsidies, which I say again, we won't need at all after 2020. That's an industry view, not just a personal view. So the Trade Association says this. We always tend to forget the subsidies that have built the energy currency. All forms of energy need subsidies, and subsidies that continue into the future. If we are ever to have a gas industry in this country, a shale gas industry in this country, it will be drowning in subsidies. And of course, Mr. Osborne has already made it quite clear that he's prepared to pay a good few of those. And they
what sort of subsidies?
Not lower tax, real money in, net money in.
Would you?
But, I mean,
sorry, that's just not true. That's a total misrepresentation of his policy.
He's on the record as saying that he will pay local authorities large sums of money.
He'll pay local authorities large sums of the money that he collects in tax. There is no net benefit to the industry from the taxpayer, quite the opposite way around. There is currently a net benefit of gigantic proportions into the renewal industry.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. Well, you can say exactly the same thing about renewals. You talk to the German Economics Ministry and they will tell you that they get more in tax from the clean energy workers that have been employed in the German industry than it has cost the German state in feed-in tariff subsidies to build the industry. So what, where's the difference?
But the average cost of creating each of these German green jobs was around €1 million each.
Yes, exactly.
That was the average cost of creating. Same in Spain too. It was about a University of Madrid study. Each green job cost €1 million. Now, I tell you, if I had €1 million, I could create a lot more than one job.
Exactly.
But I do think we're arguing about, you know, how many angels on the end of here, because if you, even the IEA will tell you that if you look at the total sum of subsidies going into the energy industry, that's, what is it, four times more going into fossil fuels than going into renewables at the moment? I forget the exact figure.
Anyway, I mean, it's good news if solar power won't need a subsidy. That's going to be interesting. Well, what I wanted also, what about the point, James Ball, that Jeremy Leggett made, and I think also that Justin alluded to, is that there's been a ton of investment going into the shale industry, but the producers have yet to see much of a return, and that could, in there comes a time when you think, hey, if I'm not actually making money, this may be good for America, it's good for America's balance of payment, it's creating incredibly well-paid jobs in North Dakota, but I'm not getting anything out of this. Indeed, I'm having to write it off.
I think that the exit, so-called exit of companies from shale, I've yet to see. Exxon quite clearly overpaid for its massive stake in shale.
But that's because they were late in.
Yes, but I don't notice them leaving. In fact, quite to the contrary, they and the Qataris have gone ahead with the Golden Pass LNG export scheme. Now, if they thought that shale wasn't profitable, I don't know about you, but I certainly have never heard of Exxon being a company that believes in loss-making investments, one of the most disciplined, organized, profit-making companies there is, and they're going ahead. I think that a lot of people are making money in it, and I will just remind you that in the 80s, there was so-called gas bubble in the U.S., where everybody thought they'd go broke, and there was too much U.S. gas that they got up to an RP ratio of 12, which is lower than it is now. And the industry carried on, the price adjusted. What I expect will happen is that if those economics are the case for the industry as a whole, that the Henry Hub price will rise, and it could afford to rise to double or triple where it is now and still make even LNG exports economic, let alone U.S. Gas versus coal and power.
I'll take some questions from the floor. One of the things I was in preparing for today, I was surprised to see, I haven't realized, that the Saudis, the UAE, and even Qatar are now taking major investments in U.S. shale. And as I understand it, it's mainly for technology transfer, that they hope to take that technology and do the same in the Middle East. Justin?
Yes, I mean, you're absolutely correct. I mean, in terms of the Saudis, that is the case, because Saudi Arabia apparently has significant deposits of shale gas. But in terms of the Qataris, that's more about hedging their bets. Yes. So they just want to make certain that perhaps they can diversify their supply, and that if U.S. shale gas, let's say,
because the Saudis are running out of conventional gas.
Correct.
So is the UAE.
They're not running. See, the issue is
the UAE is pretty close to running out.
No. No. Well, the issue is they're not.
Qatar isn't. The UAE is.
No. The UAE. nor Saudi Arabia are they running out of domestic gas. The issue is they created a type of pricing structure, pricing framework that made it quite uneconomic for them to develop their own domestic reserves. So that's the only issue. So when you talk about the Middle East and MENA countries about, let's say, domestic demand outpacing production, it's only because they have a quite unfavorable pricing structure, which hasn't been able to stimulate investment in some of these more complex gas fields.
All right, some questions from the floor. Yes, a gentleman there, right in the middle, and we've only got one mic, yeah? Time's in the stereo. We'll get this mic to you. Yes, sir.
My first question is whether Jeremy will be here this afternoon, because I think we'll be talking about the UK then, and it would be a nice opportunity to shoot him down later.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
poor guy.
He might just stay and be shot down.
Very good fun line.
I think there's not much of an incentive.
He'll be shot down, but I'll save that for this afternoon. So my question is actually for James. And the question is, why does he think that the shale industry gets such a bad press outside the US?
Well, yes, a bad press in the US too.
Well,
so that's what makes gasoline.
Demonstrating. Does he think generated by the renewable sector?
It's a very good question. I'll broaden it out to you. Why? I mean, in terms of the argument, the government seems to, or the supporters of shale gas seem to be losing it. I do think it's a PR stroke of genius if you're the main shale gas company in this country to call yourself Quadrilla.
Well,
I mean, that's just a great name to really be family friendly. Sounds like a dinosaur. But why, and do you think, I mean, let's take this huge field under Morecambe Bay, which is the low-hanging fruit, if there is any at all. When do you think we'll actually see drilling for shale begin, if at all?
Well, first of all, let me say that by no means is it universally despised in the US. And in my view, has anybody here seen the movie Gasland that Andrew referred to?
I have.
Okay, I mean, seen it. Watched the whole thing, not clips on YouTube. Not very many. That's an absolute disgrace for anybody in the energy industry. And what did the industry do wrong? They didn't speak to the guy. He started out with an open mind. And he will debate people. He goes all over the country debating people. And he passed up $1 million a year in revenue to once he made his movie. In the early days, the industry thought that they would be better off not talking to anybody. The majors don't share that view. Exxon Mobil, they have a massive program developing completely biodegradable drilling fluids, and the technology in shale is going ahead at a huge pace. But fracking, think about it, it's an easy word to make fun of. It's dangerous. And so the cleanest fossil fuel suddenly becomes the dirtiest simply by inertia. But they've done a lot to reverse that.
Will it ever be exploited commercially?
Here in the UK, the trouble is again that the very lobby that could promote it probably doesn't want to, because what a lot of people don't realize is this notion of horizontal drilling, fracking, and the UK being something new is nonsense. As far as I know, the most expensive property in all of the UK is in Poole, in Dorset. It also happens to be sitting on top of the UK's largest fracked, horizontally drilled oil field. Most people in Poole don't know this, but they're sitting on top of a giant oil field. Not desolate northeast England, but they're rich residents of Poole. It's been done harmlessly for years.
So now, why maybe is it not being done now?
Because
it should be done.
I think the twofold. I think that the government, as I said, has not promoted it properly. The companies, I agree with you, should have done a much better job. But I think maybe, Andrew, the answer was in your question, if this field, it's not a field, it's a possible play, is offshore Morecambe, why the hell don't they drill offshore? Nobody's going to mind if they do it. They've been fracking and horizontally drilling offshore North Sea for decades. No one's going to mind if they do. And I think that is the issue, and the technology drive has got to be reducing this number of wells for production, and it also has to be showing that you can definitely meet a tighter set of regulations. And finally, as I said at the close of my earlier answer to you, I think there needs to be a lot more local revenue of the vast take that the government gets from onshore production.
Because it might help if our politicians like Lord Hubble knew that Morecambe Bay was actually in the northwest of England, not the northeast.
Andrew, if I could just say just two quick things. I think if we look at gas law, and I think it should be considered who financed that particular documentary, perhaps.
The UAE.
So I think that's of interest. And then also, I think that Mr. Putin, I think he's a godsend for the PR industry of the shale gas sector. So.
Well, it's certainly true that Russia today is mounting a propaganda campaign against shale.
But what I meant is that his movements in the Ukraine and so on and so forth, I think that this, to a certain degree, will spur the European shale gas industry to at least make, to at least be more accepted.
So it's quite a few setbacks in Poland. Yes, sir.
Just to return to what Andrew said right at the very start about oil prices coming down to $66 now. Environmentalists might be pleased that makes shale gas and tar sands perhaps less attractive. But I was wondering if Jeremy could tell me what that might mean for the renewable energy industry and the green economy. Is it equally deleterious for those guys?
It's an interesting question, Jeremy. We keep on talking about the oil price being a relevant energy price when it comes to electricity generation, because we don't use any oil for electricity generation.
With one proviso there. I'd love to come back to your question, but to address that point and what you said earlier about Saudi Arabia, they do burn a lot of oil in Saudi Arabia for electricity generation.
Yes, I'm talking about here.
And it's really worrying because, you know, you go to Riyadh, as I did recently, is lit up at night like a fireworks display. And so their exports already, you can see them going down. And even if they can stay up at a capacity north of 12 million barrels a day, I think everyone here will know, you know, what's projected. If the domestic consumption continues in Saudi Arabia the way it is at the moment, then they are not going to have any oil at all to export before 2030. So this is a real issue, and it intersects with, you know, the fact that they haven't got that much.
What about the more general point? Yeah. Does the fall in oil prices and the recent, because of the shale revolution, the overall fall in gas prices, does that affect the economics of the renewables?
I think, you know, if you viewed it as a standalone issue, then it might do, but the energy policy arena is just so multivariate now, and this cost down has been so extreme and continues, and you can see what's happening in China, you pick any number of countries, France retreating from nuclear and going for, you know, a significant proportion of renewables. There are so many other sort of vectors lining up behind renewables that actually, I mean, my counsel to the solar industry is don't be as worried about this as you might have been tempted to 10 years ago, because believe me, it's creating more problems for the people who would like to put us in a box and nail down the lid. And I think, you know, I was at the Oil and Money conference recently, and you see the barely suppressed schadenfreude from the OPEC people there, and you look back at 1986 and sort of remember what happened then and who came out of that better, and it wasn't the Americans.
What happened in 86?
Oh, the Saudis, OPEC drove, mostly the Saudis drove the oil price down to $10 and ruined a lot of breakfasts in Texas and Oklahoma.
They could afford not to do breakfast in Texas. I don't know. Time for one more question. Yes, the gentleman there.
Yeah, for Mr. Paul.
Okay.
For Mr. Paul, you covered the liquid labor, etc., in the US supply side. Does that wholly explain the forecast high price of shale in the UK?
Interesting question.
the UK, what I said was that you have almost a perfect storm in what you need to rapidly develop an industry in the US. I think you have almost all of those in the UK. You do have a good industry here in Aberdeen from the North Sea. You do have a lot of infrastructure, largely in the right place. So I think that all the factors, all those supply industry, oil field services, they're called, factors are quite favorable here. I don't know why the projection is for a high price other than it's geologically difficult. As Andrew said, the places where it's theoretically in the ground, such as Poland, it isn't necessarily easy to exploit. But in Poland, everything's going against it. Here, most factors are going in its favor if only you could prove that it's there and it's near infrastructure. Morecambe would be a great place, lots of infrastructure, lots of labor. It would be a good place. It would be even handier if you found it on the East Coast near Bacton. But I think the UK's got the best chance, I would say, of any country in Europe.
All right, we'll need to leave it there, but the panel will be here for coffee. We're going to have a coffee break now, and we'll then come back and look at threats to security of supply from Russia. Please, a round of applause for our excellent panel.